So this will be about disks surrounding cataclysmic binaries. Such disks are not known to exist, so this is hypothetical. They could, at the end I'll try to convince you that they might in fact be observable with some luck. But the story, because this is hypothetical, is also, you know, in the line of a suggestion. This is an idea that we came up with in order to tie together a number of anomalies that one sees in these cataclysmic binaries. Now, and there's a preprint out already. Now, in order to explain what these anomalies are, I first have to tell you what's normal about cataclysmic binaries. And this causes a bit of a problem because there's enormous literature on these things, because they are very observable in all sorts of wavelengths. So I'll have to tell you a little bit about the classification and nomenclature and so on. So we're talking about mass transferring, small mass transferring binaries of a main sequence star and a white dwarf, accretion through a disk. This is standard, and the addition that we're going to make is that there would also be something around this binary. But forgetting that for the moment, the angular momentum loss in this binary is believed to be due to two processes. Ordinary gravitational radiation, especially for the short period systems, drives the two stars together and forces the star to overflow its Rho slope continuously, feeding this accretion disk. In many systems, this is not enough, especially for the longer period ones, and one assumes that these stars also have some form of a stellar wind, which takes away angular momentum from the star, and since it's coupled to the binary orbit by tidal forces, that causes an angular momentum loss from the orbit as well. So there's a shrinking orbit causes mass transfer from M2 to M1, the primary M1, and the observed rates, or inferred rates, from the luminosity of this disk are of the order of 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. And these higher values can only be explained by some additional angular momentum loss over and above gravitational radiation.
Okay, when Spirogate was talking, he said something about magnetic braking no longer being accepted by its original proponent. I was wondering, was he talking about these systems?
Let's see, the original proponent was Eggleton, I believe.
Eggleton and Forbindersson did it independently.
But I don't know about that, whether he still believes. Well, Eggleton was never very happy with this magnetic braking as what we now call the standard explanation for the period gap. And he still is not happy with it. Maybe he'll come back to that as well. So there's some classification to be done here. There are various kinds of these objects, and there's a very complete discussion of all of this in the book by Brian Warner, which as of 1995 was essentially complete, but it's also quite readable in my opinion. Classification nomenclature, basically there are two classes, the dwarf novae and the nova-likes. The dwarf novae go through outbursts and they have rather low average angular momentum, mass transfer rates, whereas the nova-likes appear to be accreting steady with higher accretion rates. That's the one thing to remember. The other thing is this period gap, which plays an important role in the whole discussion. Sorry, it has to be up rather than down. There's a sort of an absence of systems in the period range of 2 to 3 hours, and below 80 minutes it goes down, except for a small class of binaries with helium secondaries, which have very short periods.
What are the numbers of those?
These arms?
Yeah, about how many systems do they have?
Well, this would be on the order of 100 or so, and a few hundred here.
But I think the relative population, if you're asking about actually the relative populations, as opposed to just what's observed.
Oh, I just wanted what's observed too. I always have fears, and this is a field I don't know, but whenever they have period gaps, I always have fears that the numbers are
unique. Yeah. This is also part of a continual debate. Some people still don't believe it exists. And of course, The statistics is such that you can always have some doubts here, but this is the period gap. Only the systems between systems below 5 hours, and you know, then there's here this cumulative distribution, and you can do tests and things. But I think everybody essentially believes it is real.
But in this picture, the gap doesn't look like a real gap.
Yeah, there's systems in the gap. It's not a.
There's a few. It's not an absolute gap.
It's not an absolute gap, right?
This one includes magnetic systems.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
right. The magnetic systems don't show again.
Yes. So then we have to further divide these systems into particular subgroups, and the way to perhaps do this is by this is all historical, of course, but because these names are around, I have to tell them. Above the gap and below the gap, they have different names. Above the gap, the steady accretors are nova-likes, also called UXUMAS, SW6-Tanta systems, which are a more extreme form of those. And a few of the so-called super soft sources, which are, has been suggested, and I'll argue as well, are just a high, very high mass transfer extension of these nova-likes. And then, but it's only a fraction of the super soft sources; it's a subgroup of them. And then, if they have outbursts, they're called dwarf novae. Below the period gap, these steady sources, there are several of those as well, the ER-UMA systems, and a few of the so-called AM-Canvan stars, that's these very short period binaries which have helium secondaries. And the outbursting systems are called SU-UMA systems, and in the more extreme ones are called TOADs. Oh, it's a ridiculous abbreviation. Tremendous amplitude outburst dwarf novae. Don't ask me.
Tremendous outburst amplitude.
But there's other classifications as well that have that are sort of independent of this scheme. There are magnetic ones, the AM Hirth stars, and the less magnetic ones, the DQ Hirth star or intermediate polars. And then, of course, there's a whole class of them that are known to be old novae, and they can be of any kind, basically. So a standard picture has.
I think the TOAD is actually more descriptive than any of the other names. So in that sense, it's not too bad. The only thing is, you get a problem if the outburst is even stronger. What are you going to use?
What's particularly
frogs.
Toady about them?
Frogs.
At least the abbreviation means something sensible, rather than where on the sky the prototype is. I mean.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
Obviously.
Well, it's easier. It's true, yeah. So there is a standard picture that has developed on the basis of, you know, theoretical ideas on these systems. First, there's a whole literature on these outbursts. I don't go into that here because it's not part of not relevant for the rest. The outbursts are due to some kind of instability in the accretion disk itself, which disappears if the disk has a sufficiently high accretion rate. This is believed to be understood. The other part is that we believe that the standard picture says that the evolution of these systems is from the high period to the low period because angular momentum is lost, and that this is then due to magnetic braking and gravitational radiation in such a way that at roughly the time when the star becomes fully convective, this happens at three-hour period roughly, the magnetic braking somehow stops. So that all of a sudden the accretion rate goes down by some factor of 10 or so. And then you can show that since these stars were slightly out of equilibrium, they'll contract a little bit, they're not mass transferring anymore, they just cross this gap and then start transferring mass again.
Why does that only convect even the period is 3 hours?
Well, you know, you have to sort of during this period, they are slightly expanded stars, but they're pretty close to main sequence stars still. So you can ask yourself the question, if the primary has a mass of, say, one solar mass or half a solar mass, what is the binary orbital period for a star of open three solar masses, for example? You find it's 3 hours. Um, So then we have the nova-likes above the gap. This is what this picture predicts, because it's high mass transfer rates. And we have the dwarf novae below the period gap. This is what this picture predicts, because it's low mass transfer rates. And it also predicts that these here, as well as the ones here, the secondaries are, well, they're somewhat expanded because of the mass transfer, but they're still pretty close to the main sequence. Is this...
Why the magnetic braking stops working when the star becomes convective?
Yes. Well, there is only circumstantial evidence. The theoretical evidence is, of course, the weakest. But the argument is always made that, for example, for the Sun, we have a pretty good idea that the magnetic field is created at the boundary between the convection zone and the interior. So if there is no boundary between a convection zone and an interior, then the dynamo must somehow be different. And then, for a while, there was observational evidence, or people believed there was observational evidence. The degree of activity, for example, X-rays for a given rotation period, was lower. And that's still sort of true, but these stars, they don't stop being active completely. There's still some residual magnetic activity going on. So whether or not it's actually a good explanation is not really clear.
I mean, there was also another explanation by Dan Stone and Mazzatelli that because the star goes fully convective, you remix the elements, and in particular, the remixing of the helium-3 that's been made in the core changes the beam length in a way enough that the new state of the star is smaller. So I think it's not clear why. I think the fact that it falls out of contact is not a surprise.
But these things have been studied to death, and particularly this example, this proposal has also been computed, and it's very hard to get such a big gap.
It's hard to get that big gap.
It's a very small effect. So does this agree with observations? We're now getting to the anomalies part. Well, it turns out there are various anomalies. First, in this previous picture, there was some sort of a canonical way in which this thing is supposed to develop. Its orbital period decreases, given just by a standard formula for this angular momentum loss by magnetic braking. So you would expect a very nicely defined variation of the mass transfer rates as a function of orbital period. And this is not the case at all. In fact, it's pretty bad. This was already known for a long time. This is, for example, from Warner, 87, where he plots the absolute magnitudes. This is, of course, not exactly the same as accretion rates, but for the systems where the distances are known, since the range is so large, you can just as well call this an accretion rate. And you can see that here's the period gap, that below the period gap as well as above the period gap, there is an enormous range in magnitudes, in brightness of these systems. Now, the brightness of these systems all comes from the at least for these periods, comes from the accretion disk, not from the secondary. Only at periods above, say, 8 hours or so, does the secondary start contributing. So it's all the accretion luminosity that you're seeing. And it varies by orders of magnitude, above the period gap as well as below. This is the level you expect from gravitational radiation. And, it's clear that there are many systems that are higher than that. So this does not agree very well. Where's my sheet here? The second anomaly is that the distribution of nova-likes and dwarf novae above as well as below the period gap is not what you expect either. I showed the curve that the magnetic braking scenario predicts that the accretion rate goes down as you approach the period gap, so that you would get more and more of the low mass transfer systems in your sample, which are the dwarf novae. You see the opposite. As you approach the period gap, the systems become nova-likes. In the 3 to 4 hour period, there's essentially no dwarf novae. They're all nova-likes. and then there are a few extreme cases, which you can throw out as not belonging to cataclysmic variables at all. But there are short period super soft sources which actually behave very much like nova-like systems.
Sorry, hang on. So above the gap,
claiming you understand whether a system is a dwarf globule or a noble light really depends on the understanding of the physics of the disk instability quite well. I mean, there's a nominally factor of 10 drop in m dot when you come above and below the period gap. Presumably, that's crossing the boundary between stable and unstable. Though there are some dwarf globule above the gap, do you think you actually know well enough the physics to that point 2 actually has any?
People are reasonably happy with it because there are also these systems in between systems, the Z-CAM systems, which sometimes show outbursts and then the accretion rate happens to be a bit higher or steady. And it marks a boundary which agrees with the transition between disks which are partly convective and disks which are always radiative. And this transition between convective and radiative structure is one of the main ingredients that triggers the instability in the standard model. So people are happy with it. It might be still a coincidence. We're not entirely sure. I would say, well, I think most practitioners would be very happy with the picture that we really understand much of this outburst physics. But, you know, it still involves major uncertainties. You have to put in certain viscosities, for example, which you don't know. One of the important anomalies is that you see funny line profiles in overlikes, and says SW6 Dantes and super soft sources. Now, in order to show what a funny like profile is, I first have to show you a normal profile. Am I that far yet? I think I can do that for a moment, yeah. A normal line profile, say for the Balmer lines, for example, of a dwarf nova in quiescence depends on the inclination of the system. If you see it at intermediate inclinations, you see a slightly double-humped line profile, and you say, ah, nice, there's a disk rotating, and I see part coming to me, towards me, and another part's going away. At higher inclination, this becomes a very deep central dip. This just as observed. For example here, WZ Sagitti. This is now a time-dependent spectrum where you see all sorts of interesting structures in it, but the main point is just there are two peaks to the line profile. Now this is different in the nova-like systems, especially in the SW sextantive systems, where instead, and the funny thing is these are systems, many of them at high inclination.
Eclipsing myself?
Eclipsing systems or partially eclipsing systems. And in those cases, you don't see this deep dip at all. Instead, you see sort of a broad line, but in addition, a narrow emission peak on top of it. And this is especially clear in some of the systems which I would like to associate with this class of nova-likes, in particular the supersoft sources and, for example, the AMCAN-VEN stars. A nice example here. Now, these are helium secondary, so there's no hydrogen lines in the spectrum. And the double lines are quite broad because it's a very small system and the orbital velocities are very high. So you see very broad helium lines, but on top of it, a narrow emission peak. So this has been interpreted in various ways and is still not entirely clear. But a good possibility is that it has to do with outflowing material. Somehow, some of the mass that's, instead of accreting, is expelled by the disk at fairly low velocities, a few hundred kilometers per second, up to 1,000 or so, and sort of hangs around. It's one of the suggestions made by Keith Horn, for example. And an explicit statement that this is circumbinary material was made by Solheim and Cyan for AMCAN-VEN.
Cannot be the base of the secondary, which is sort of the one would think in LMXB seconds.
The illuminated face of the secondary. Well, that's very easily distinguished because it causes a wiggle in the phase dependent.
So you don't see that.
You don't see that, no. So one of the super soft sources, yeah, does the same thing. Huh? A broad emission line, and on top of it, a very narrow spike. So now my proposal here is that there's a physical link between these anomalies, namely that there might be an excretion disk. They're also called external disks by people who think that excretion is a vulgar term.
Pringle said you should call them decretion disks.
Yeah, this is Pringle, in fact. I like to call them E-disks for external or excretion disks. But,
Not electronic.
Yeah. Or circumbinary disks. In this suggestion, this is not the suggestion I'm making. There's a slow outflow from the systems where we have large accretion rates of the order of 500 to 700 kilometers per second. This just follows from the line profiles. And now assume that part of this material is able to settle into the orbital plane by some kind of condensation process. And then the tidal torque, there's a binary spinning inside this whole thing, makes this mass spread out into a disk, something like this. There's a hypothetical process that makes part of this disk material flow out and condense outside. What is the evidence that there's such material? Well, apart from these line profiles, there is also evidence from eclipses. There are systems which are absolutely 90 degree, fully eclipsing systems, in which one from the geometry knows that the accretion disk must be completely eclipsed as well. And in those cases, one often sees so-called uneclipsed light. In the line profiles, part of the eclipse is not as deep as in the continuum, for example. So there is optically thin material, Balmer-emitting material, which apparently is uneclipsed. People say, okay, bit of a wind. So that's this here, and I'm now using it to condense into a disk. Now.
Yeah. You're taking material from the inner disk and making the outer disk from it. But I guess the secondary could potentially have to drop to, a point where it expels stuff directly outward as well as passes material.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that be another way to make a disk?
Well, of course, the secondary also loses some mass. That's true, because you're assuming this magnetic braking process. But
I'm just wondering, you're bringing it from the inside and putting it on the outside instead of just sort of squirting it out the back.
Well, yes, but the outer Lagrange point is quite a ways from the surface of the secondary.
Yeah.
The potential barrier is enormous, it's several hundred kilometers a second. So you really need to kick something a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why am I saying the outer disk? Because one also observes fast winds often. In the UV, for example, of a few thousand kilometers per second from the inner disk. Well, that could also flow out and maybe condense, but of course the slower material has a much larger chance of actually settling into some orbit. So, and since one actually sees in these narrow emission components material of the order of a few hundred kilometers per second, so the full width is, say, 1,000 or 1,200 kilometers a second, that's the more, I think, perhaps more likely source of it. What causes this is not, of course, unclear. There could be some kind of magnetic outflow process involved.
It is sort of the splash where the stream from the secondary...
Maybe, yes, perhaps.
There was work on irradiated disks. The flux from the disk alone, sorry, not irradiation, the flux from the disk alone would be able to excite light, much like in a massive star.
Yeah, in a program drew, yeah.
So did that stuff not work, or was that...?
Well, it certainly works, but only for very high luminosities of the central source. Because you have to be in that state where the ionization degrees of ionization are such that you can actually have a strong driving of the wind. And I suppose that there's really a good, potentially good model for this high wind. But perhaps also even for the outer disk, I don't know. Perhaps it is. I don't want to be too specific about it because it's really a hypothetical point.
Yeah.
for the model.
Okay, and then this picture, the central spikes, where it comes from, central spike over there.
Yeah. This would be material that is sort of flowing out, sort of slightly isotropically, at the speed of, say, 500 to 700 kilometers per second. So you see then something, if it's optically thin, you see something that just has the width of that velocity,
ejected so velocity. And this would be this pedestal.
No, the pedestal that you saw is probably the accretion. It's much broader. It's a few thousand.
Okay, 2,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so you think the spike comes from the outer parts and this pedestal?
Yeah, this pedestal is somehow the emission from the inner disk. Or perhaps a fast wind that comes from the inner disk.
Still, this outer disk is rotating. Should observe some
heat
in that narrow spike. Then.
Yeah. Well, of course, one also sees, say, in the normal, say, in the lower accretion rate systems, one sees this line profile of the disk, and its emission lines also, the Balmer lines, for example, in WCGTI, as I showed here, it's also an emission line with a strong central absorption. And this strong central absorption is understood. It has to do with self-absorption in the disk itself. It's not really the fact that, it is due to the disk, but it's a little bit more complicated than you would think. So we think that we know what a disk at high inclination looks like. It should have these double peak line profiles. And if you see a single peak, then you think, well, something else, maybe just an outflow that is more transparent, so it doesn't have a disk geometry. And in order to make this more plausible that this could happen, an analogy here, BE star disks. There one has, by interpretation of observations, material outside the star. The star is fairly rapidly rotating, but not at breakup, more like half breakup speed. They're observed to have a fast wind, high ionization wind, driven by radiation pressure, presumably. And then there's low degree of ionization material that is often in emission, Balmer lines in emission. In the UV, it's in absorption, and it has iron emission and absorption lines in it. And it's believed to be in the form of a disk. And this disk, according to current models, for example, Bjorkman and Cassinelli, is believed to be somehow fed by this polar outflow, by some kind of compression into the equatorial plane. So we have here a source of material for this disk, but it's of course a source of material that has essentially no angulamentum, because at larger distance this material stopped rotating, and the angulamentum at the surface of the star was not enough to get it out here. So for this model to work, that it's a condensation of the polar wind, you additionally have to have in BE stars an angulamentum input process that puts angulamentum into this disk so that it can spread out and this material doesn't fall back into the star. And that's where the models sort of diverge. I would think it's most likely to be just some kind of magnetosphere of the star itself that causes angulamentum output.
But this is not the only model to make this disk. So I know Andre Madère showed some plot where he had some instability in the star because of rotation and opacity, which then created the disk. And it was just he had more radiation pressure essentially in the equator and he formed the disk. So that.
Yeah.
I think that's for the main sequence BE stars. That's for the so-called B bracket E, if we want to go into nomenclature.
These stars, they still have an enormous potential barrier here.
I'm not sure that this is a completely adaptive model either, but I think it's probably the best there is at the moment.
People talk a lot in this literature about mode switching. These things also are known radial pulsators. And I've never understood this, but people believe that these modes can somehow kick out mass into a disk. Totally unbelievable, in my opinion. Anyway, so this model, these observations have their own problems, but at least we have here an example of a wind that apparently can feed a cool equatorial disk. So it may not be too uncommon. they have these line profiles, huh? And they go through all sorts of interesting things, like this is Pleione in the Pleiades. It can be a normal B star for a while, and then become a shell star, where somehow this material is along the line of sight, and you see lots of absorption lines. And then it becomes normal B star. Yeah, first a BE, normal B star, a shell phase, a BE star, and a shell phase again. When it's in its BE phase, then you see H-alpha profiles like this. So there's a lot of observations of these things. Gamma Cas, asymmetry between the blue and the red, is also very, very characteristic of these systems. So I'm now just going to assume that that we have this disk and it's fed by some kind of mass coming from that has to do with the accretion itself. It's not mass that comes from the secondary star in this picture. It comes from the accretion. It's a fraction of the accretion. Now, if I have this material surrounding the binary, then the viscous dissipation in that disk means that there's a torque acting on the binary, which makes it lose angular momentum to the disk. The disk, in response, takes its angular momentum out and spreads it outward. Now, how much mass do I feed into this disk? This, of course, you have to specify it. Let's now assume that it is, in fact, related to the accretion. So let's make it scale with the accretion rate. So m dot e, the mass flux in the external disk, is minus the rate of change of the mass of the secondary times some multiplicator, which should be smallish. Then there will be two torques on this binary, one having to do with this external disk, and then the addition, I would still like to stick to our old idea that there's also an ordinary magnetic torque from the magnetic wind of the secondary. So two contributions.
How does the m dot in your magnetic wind compare to your m dot e?
That would be, let's see, the m dot in magnetic wind is not entirely negligible. It could be, it would be a bit smaller than this, maybe 10 to the minus 4 or so. Because these Alfvénger radii are pretty large for these stars.
But I mean, are you worried about the interaction of your disk wind with your magnetic wind?
It is in principle also a possibility to have part of the secondary wind condense. It'll give you a rather different picture, because then it's not related to m dot anymore. And I'm using the observational fact that you see these outflows, particularly in the high m dot systems. Then there's a torque, this contribution from the external disk. You can just compute, if you knew the surface density distribution in the disk, then at each point you can calculate the viscous torque in this disk. And that's the torque that has to be provided by the binary. So if you have a viscous model for the disk, and you know where the inner edge of the disk is, then you can also compute of this external disk. Then you can compute the torque on it from just standard viscous disks. Now, let's now look at the case where after a certain amount of time and lots of mass has built up into this disk, so that after a while, this torque, the external torque, starts dominating over the wind torque. In that case, since I'm still assuming that the external mass flux into the external disk is proportional to the accretion rate, you'll find the following. The orbital mechanics and the Roche geometry specify the amount of mass that has to be transferred from the secondary to the primary if I take away angular momentum from the orbit with a certain torque here. Because the secondary has to shrink, mass has to be transferred. This torque now, since we assume that the circumbinary disk dominates, is proportional to the circumbinary torque, and this circumbinary torque, by my assumption, is proportional to the accretion rate. So we have here a positive feedback situation. The more mass is transferred, the more it flows out into the disk, and the larger becomes the torque by the external disk. So this could be, that's now the hope, that this could be a self-feeding process that makes the accretion rate run away. So you can explain these very high accretion rates, Novalax, and even the super soft sources.
So the matter that leaves the outer edge of the disk has to gain angular momentum?
Well, yes. First of all, it could just move out without acquiring any new angular momentum. It then settles onto the disk and finds this disk rotating rapidly. So it picks up angular momentum from the disk. That has to come from where? From somewhere, of course. And that's the torque that the spinning binary, the tidal torques of the binary, exert on the disk. If this disk spreads in slowly, it both feeds, feel the tidal torques, which increase very steeply as I approach this binary. The spin of the binary puts angular momentum into the disk.
I'm sort of wondering why you don't use sort of the leftover of the common envelope phase.
Yes.
These external disks are essentially indestructible, right? Because there's no reason for them ever to disappear. I hate this model almost as instantly, because it means you have this arbitrary parameter of how much matter you leave in a circumbinary disk.
Yep.
And that sets the whole further evolution.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. That has something to do with the... would be good to keep that in mind as a possibility. That somehow...
It's very easy to see that you're left with some matter after the spiral in a circumbinary.
Could be.
But if you do that, then you don't have the dependency.
No, you don't. It would be an arbitrary parameter.
Yeah, it would be
a free parameter variable.
It's always like that in theory.
Maybe Nova outbursts destroy them. This would be nice.
Yes. Yeah, that's not entirely clear, in fact. Nova is fairly powerful, and there's not that much mass in these disks. But it all depends on your viscosities, which is the main uncertainty here as well, but more so than in accretion disks. I'll come to that, hopefully. So we have now, in this picture, we have two phases. And there is an initial phase in which the mass transfer is just the ordinary mass transfer driven by magnetic breaking. During this time, the external torque is small, and the external disk just slowly grows in mass. And let's make life easy. There's, of course, secular evolution of this binary as well, but let's just take the mass accretion rate constant during this time as an approximation. Then after that, as the surface density increases and the torque, the viscous torques increase, then the torque on the binary increases, becomes larger than the wind torque. And in that case, as I just showed, you'll have an unstable situation in which the surface density as well as the mass accretion rate grow exponentially. So there are two phases here. So now some calculations, because of course you want to have some equations in the paper as well. And there is of course a certain literature already on disk spreading outward from something. Pringle has done analytic models, and there's some more calculations with more detailed physics for the disks by Lee, Sayo and Ozaki. When you deal with these disks, the first thing you have to realize that if you're used to the intuition of normal accretion disks, these things behave differently. In a normal accretion disk, there's a sort of a proportionality between accretion rate and surface density. You increase the accretion rate, after a while, after some transients, the surface density is higher. That's not the case here. There's a much less direct connection between the mass flux and the surface density. And that's because such an external disk is essentially non-stationary. It's never stationary. There can be parts of it that, you know, look more or less stationary, but even there you don't have the same scaling between surface density and m dot that you have in an accretion, ordinary accretion disk. But you can still use your ordinary thin disk equation for the diffusion of mass if you know the viscosity. Let's now make a simple model in which the viscosity is a function of radius only, some kind of a power law. And let's scale that introduce as radial variable r to the 1/2, scaled with the inner radius of the disk. As a variable, I use here this viscous stress number, y, and scale the time with the viscous time at the inner edge of the disk, it's this quantity here, then it becomes this simple diffusion equation with only one space-dependent coefficient in it. We then simplify even further by saying, well, n equals 1 is a convenient number, so this coefficient becomes constant. In other words, I'm assuming that the viscosity is proportional to radius, just to get the first impression. Then it becomes the simplest possible diffusion equation. And I can now analyze it for its behavior in these two phases. An initial phase in which the external torque is small and there's only a constant magnetic wind torque. The initial phase then, the mass fed into the disk, here that's m dot at the inner edge of the disk, which has to be balanced by an outward gradient of the surface density, essentially, that this will then be constant in time. And then you'll find that this simple, for this case, where the coefficient here is constant, that this the solution of this equation, if the initial mass in the disk is zero, if there's initially no mass, solution of this is exactly a self-similar solution. And details of self-similar solutions for this kind of equation you can find in Zeldovich and Reiser, for example. And that means that the solution is the time to some power times a function of a combination of time and distance, x minus 1 times tau to the power of lambda. Well, you have to just, you can guess this, or you can deduce it, that this is the way to do it, but you can always check by putting it into the equation. You'll find that mu must be a half and lambda is minus a half. And then there are, then this equation reduces from time and space to just one ODE. And the solution turns out to have the following dependencies. Surface density goes as t to the 1/2, proportional to the mass input that I put in, r to the minus 3/2, times a cutoff function that sort of gives an end to the disk. And this has to do with
And that not slowly moves out?
Yeah, this moves slowly out as also as t to the 1/2.
Oh yeah, which is in that.
Because it is this xi variable here. In the unstable phase, the thing is the same, except the boundary condition is now different, because the mass flux is now proportional to the torque exerted, and this can then be translated into a boundary condition that the gradient at the inner edge is proportional to the function at the value at the inner edge itself. So a slightly different boundary condition. And this constant of proportionality has to do with the properties of the orbit, and in particular, on this fraction of the mass transfer rate, delta, that I've put into the disk as an external mass flux. And then you'll find that because of this boundary condition is now homogeneous, so the solutions of this equation is now a homogeneous system, and you can find solutions of it by looking at the relevant solution, by looking at the most unstable mode. That's the one that will dominate after a while. And it turns out to be the simplest possible thing, e to the k squared times t minus k times x, where k is this number here. So putting these together, we've solved it in here, in this range, and in this range. Here it grows exponentially. Here it increases at t to the 1/2. And in between it does something. And you'll find that the instability timescale in this phase is just the same as the time it took from zero to get to the unstable situation. But there's only one timescale in the process. And not surprisingly, it scales with the viscous timescale of this disk. And it's basically 1 over delta squared. Delta was this small number that relates the external mass flux to the accretion rate. 1 over delta squared times the viscous timescale of the disk. So it's a large number of viscous timescales, which will then adjust so that this timescale comes in the range of, say, 10 to the 8 years, so that some of the systems will become large mass transfer rates and others are not there yet. You can do this slightly more generally by putting in a viscosity, which is also dependent on surface density. In that case, it turns out the solutions are only of this diffusion equation are only self-similar asymptotically for large t, and in that regime then they have a similar kind of behavior. They go some power of time, and this power now has to do with these two indices here. We can make estimates of how much mass there is in this disk, for example. And you then have to put in numbers for the viscosity, your real physical numbers. And that's where, of course, our uncertainty comes in. You have to specify an alpha viscosity. It turns out that likely numbers for temperature will be around 1,000 degrees. And the surface density then something like 100 times 1 over alpha. The alpha is a tenth or a hundredth, then it could be 1,000 to 10,000 grams per square centimeter surface densities. So this brings us then to the subject of observability. Maybe I don't actually have to go into it, but you can calculate the luminosity of this disk. It's just the torque that is exerted between the disk and the binary times the orbital frequency at the inner edge of the disk. And if you compare that with the accretion rate, in this limit where the torque to the by the binary disk dominates over the wind torque, you can just compare these two numbers, and you'll find that the ratio of luminosity just has to do with the depth of the potential well for accretion compared to the potential well at the point where this takes place, times a small number delta squared. And this is all very vague, but because you have to make these numbers much more precise. But it turns out it could be of the order of 10 to the minus 5 or so of the accretion luminosity. Could choose conditions a bit differently, so it could be a bit more. Perhaps it's even less. So their observability is not very good, because the difficulty is that most of the light that you see comes from a very deep potential well where lots of energy is dissipated close to the white dwarf. And you have to somehow find a regime in wavelength where the disk dominates. And that turns out to be in the infrared, perhaps in the L-band, it might be possible to see them. So let me then summarize observationally, there's evidence for some kind of outflow, perhaps even direct observational evidence for circumbinary material, as Solheim and Cyan propose, in some of the high accretion rate CVs. And by analogy with BE stars, we propose that condensation takes place into some kind of an equatorial disk outside the binary. This torque, this disk exerts an additional torque on the binary by which it is forced to go together faster, which means an enhanced accretion rate, which would then explain the high that the phenomenon is related to high accretion rate systems. It's possible to have a runaway growth. As soon as the torque by the disk dominates over the magnetic braking torque, you have an exponential growth in principle of the accretion rate, and we believe that this might explain the short period supersoft sources, and perhaps also the SW600 system. In this interpretation, Nova-like supersoft sources, SW600 systems, are ones where somehow the disk is massive, right? Lots of mass is accumulated in the disk, perhaps because these are older systems. They have had enough time for mass to be fed into the disk. One of the consequences of this high mass transfer rate is that in this picture, it is a continuous high mass transfer rate. There are alternative explanations for Nova-likes in which it is assumed that they go through cycles. Sometimes they're Nova-like, then they're dwarf novae for a while, and then they're Nova-like, so that the average accretion rate is normal. In this interpretation, these things do not have normal average accretion rates. They have enhanced average accretion rates, and this means that their companions are now much more strongly affected by the mass loss. In fact, if you go through the numbers, you'll find that the typical secondary for a Nova-like would be an enormously expanded star. It would have a much lower mass than you would estimate from its orbital period. And this might explain some observational aspects. For example, Nova Lights, people have tried to find the secondaries. The secondary is known for just spectroscopically seen for many dwarf novae above the period cap, but none of the Nova Lights. Maybe it's because they're so expanded that they're too cool to be seen. The other consequence is that we interpret the AM Canvan stars, at least the high master transfer cases among the AM Canvans, and the ER UMAS as cases below the period gap, but also where also this large this CB disk is active. And finally, if you put this to its logical consequence, if you have this runaway instability, then mass, it turns out the mass of the secondary just declines indefinitely in such a way that it dissolves in a finite time. This is an analytic, well, not an analytic, but it's a simple model for the evolution of a binary with this additional torque in it. If I don't have the additional torque, then just the ordinary angular momentum loss by the magnetic braking will make the mass transfer, the mass of the secondary decrease like this. And you basically have to wait more than a Hubble time to actually dissolve this star because it goes down exponentially, decreasing rate. If, on the other hand, I allow for this CB disk to add torque and it goes into this unstable phase, then it can actually dissolve the secondary in a finite time. So,
at that time, this circumbinary disk probably contains like a 10 solar mass or something.
At some point, it becomes bigger than the secondary. And then, of course, this picture has to be somewhat modified because then it's more like a planet orbiting in a disk than that. Well, that's basically it.
Is it natural? Is there some reason you would know that the temperature has to be less than 1,000 Kelvin or more than 1,000 Kelvin? I mean, it's a neutral material. That's what worries me. Is it clear to you that it will be neutral material?
It's not at all clear, in particular because there is a potentially strong source of illumination by this type of star. All depends on how the...
I guess what I'm wondering about is in further planets, well, further stellar disks, you know, people worry a lot about the viscosity and the cause of the viscosity, and those are a little bit hotter, I guess.
Yeah.
Thousand is pretty cold.
Thousand is real cold, and you don't.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be the
In CV disks, in quiescence, especially in WZ Jetty stars with these enormous recurrence times, it has been argued that the temperatures will become so low that it becomes essentially unionized. This is Manu and Gami's proposal for the low viscosity in these disks. But here would be more extreme. These conditions, in fact, are quite similar to circumbinary disks in protostellar binaries. And there, of course, people have spent a certain amount of effort in trying to figure out the opacities and, you know, grain formation and grain settling in the disk. It becomes very complicated. But if only a small fraction of the accretion luminosity that comes from near the white dwarf illuminates this disk, then you would have very different conditions. But that's not entirely clear either, because it depends on how this disk looks like. How do I push buttons here? Seen from the, here's the secondary. Seen from here, this is essentially a point source. So it depends very much whether the disk is thicker here than there or not. If it's thicker here, then there will be a strong illumination at this point, but the disk will be self-shielding.
But what's the thickness relative to the orbital radius?
Here it's about a hundredth or so. Or a few hundredths.
Can you see any of this from orbital period decays or induced eccentricities in that
mean, you expect a certain binary just to induce eccentricity, but obviously you have a very nice damping mechanism with a Roche of filling star too.
Well, it's interesting because there are definitely eccentricities in BE star disks. That's whole phenomenology associated with this V to R asymmetry. Sometimes they go through cycles in which sometimes the red wing of the H alpha line is stronger than the blue wing, and then it changes and it goes back and forth. And this is sometimes interpreted as due to a one-armed spiral mode traveling this disk, traveling in this disk. One-armed spirals are special because they're they go with sound speed, basically. It's a sound speed traveling through the disk. This is what Kato showed a long time ago already. And these frequencies sort of fit. So it's possible that for some reason these disks become unstable to an m equals 1, at least in BE stars, m equals 1 perturbation. And they might do the same here. And might even be important for, who knows, mass for the viscosity, that at some point it becomes a large amplitude wave.
And did you try to estimate the infrared flux of such disk?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be really observable?
In terms of flux, no problem. These are bright in K and L. However, the disk, the accretion disk, is very much brighter. Well, it's not entirely clear. It depends exactly in which wavelength band you are. In L, our estimates was that they could be comparable. Perhaps even in K, they could be comparable.
How big do you expect them to be?
Say, the typical estimate for the inner edge of such a circumbinary disk is 1.7 times the orbital separation. So that gives you a size on the order of a few times 10 to the 11, or say 10 to the 23 square centimeters or so.
But the outer edge just goes out,
outer
more or less.
Yeah, okay. Well, in these models that I showed here with this simple viscosity prescription, it goes out very, very far, and realistically far, in fact.
Oh, yeah, because the viscosity just increases.
Yes. But if you put in, say, a mild dependence on surface density, then it changes completely. Then you get a real edge to the disk, which moves out slowly, and you get typically, after, you know, Hubble time or so, maybe 10 to 100 times the orbital separation.
Okay. Are any of these really close that you could actually maybe cut out some of the inner disk, you know, when you're observing?
Well, in fact, we just, you know, in the nick of time before the end of the, before the deadline, we submitted an observing proposal to do just that by taking eclipsing systems. Nice eclipsing your Juma systems, and then following the infrared course through eclipse. See if that gives anything.
Great. Thanks, Hank.